You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
I don't want to date myself, but this song was pretty big when I was a kid. Joining me are Jeff Kenny, Tim Lynch. Timmy, what's going on?
Not much, Mac. We're locked down here in Southern Texas.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And Jeff Kenny in Southern California, I think.
I am. I'm self-quarantined, and everybody around me is happy about that.
I would think so. I wanted to start with how about the little disinformation campaign that the Chinese all of a sudden started running like late last week when one of their State Department guys said, yeah, the United States needs to fess up and needs to come clean with the people of the world and tell the truth about their American soldiers coming to Wuhan last year and planting this virus. And it's like, and I was watching people react to the president saying yesterday, calling it this Chinese virus. And people were like, whoa, what do you mean? It's like, do you guys who are in this business not pay attention on a daily basis to stories on the wire and shit like that? And it's like they can't, you know? Yeah. It strikes me as like so stupid. It's like you don't read current events and you're a part of it.
I know. It's like it's their own words from 2 months ago where they were all calling it that. You know?
Hey, if I'm not mistaken, that Chinese information operation, when it started, that was, it seems to me, the exact day the media turned on a dime and started declaring any reference to Wuhan or Chinese viruses as racism. It was on a dime, and it happened uniformly across every platform, I guess, except for Fox, I guess.
I don't know. I don't know about uniformly across every platform, but
it sure seemed that way.
It just to me is stunning when you see this bullshit, and people aren't paying attention, right, to current events to know, like, you don't know what he's pushing back on?
Yeah.
Is this bullshit?
Or are they pretending they don't know?
Oh. Well, you know, that's a good question. So it's like, well, you know, I don't know which is worse. You know, either you don't know or you do know.
It's all pretty bad.
And you're acting like you don't. But it's just stupid. You know, it's just stupid. And there's an article that I saw in Real Clear Politics today, and the headline is Beijing fears COVID-19 is a turning point for China and globalization.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And it's a pretty interesting thing, and written by a guy by the name of Michael Auslin, Auslin, and I'll put it up in this podcast. And he talks about it, and that's about 10 minutes. And I played it in the first hour, but sometimes it's like. You got to be shitting me, man. And again, this is once again, China's going to tell us, right? You're our dancing chicken. We're going to crank up the music and start dancing, okay?
Yeah.
Because what everybody knows is true isn't true.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. It's amazing.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like it relates to what we were saying about how everything seemed to turn all at once, like geese, you know? The geese all turn the same way because the lead geese flies that way. It's like amazing to me. The whole thing with like when Biden started winning, all these other candidates just dropped away, even though they had been virulently against him during the debates. And he normally was coming out. He's lucky to break fourth or fifth in these early primaries. And all of a sudden, all on a dime, it all changes. They all give up at the same time. They all have their delegates go to him. And it's just like, you're like, what the hell happened? All at once. And then the same thing with this Chinese thing. It's like Timmy was saying, on a dime, those guys decided to say, hey, you know, they're making fun of the president for putting in the travel ban effect in the first. He actually started making moves to do that stuff while they're still in impeachment fever, you know. And then on a all at once, as if there was like a one, as if Arthur Fiedler was conducting them. You know, they all started playing the low notes.
My mother loved Arthur Fiedler.
Yeah, yeah.
She loved Ray
Lawrence
Conniff.
Welk.
She loved Ray
Conniff. And a Tua.
She loved Ray Conniff too. Yeah. Just for the record, Timmy, thoughts on that?
Yeah, I wrote about that earlier today, and I don't like how our media is playing politics with this virus and stoking fears. And I don't like how so much of the coverage from the very beginning were the experts in the Boston-Washington corridor talking about how we're all going to die because Trump isn't handling this right. Mm-hmm. And then continuing to pound away on him, as it appears to me. I mean, a week ago when the president came on and did that news conference, it was awful. He did an awful job. But ever since then, every time he gets in front of the TV, it seems to me to be effective. And we're handling this the best way that we can, although I don't understand how all of a sudden now this big bubble is coming in caseloads when we were exposed to this virus since at least November. I suspect it's already burned through the population to a considerable degree.
I agree. I smell a rat, as I have said to me. Lori's about to vomit, and he's saying it again. And the reason is because I was sick as a dog back in I remember talking about it on the podcast here. How you guys doing? Max says, Jeff, how are you? I'm like, oh, I'm about to die here. And that's the reason not to do the podcast. And I just drink alcohol. I think that's what everybody should do, actually. But my point is that I think I already got this thing, and I've had it for a while, and I'm over with it. And I think, I don't know for sure. I don't know. I'm no scientist or anything like that. But I just think that, there's so much zeal. You see the gleam in the eye of Governor Cuomo and of Mayor de Blasio and Governor, Newsom, when they talk about people having a shelter in place and they're not going to be able to go out and do this. And I'm going to ban them from going to bars and stuff. And I'm like, you guys love some martial law. Whenever you can make they don't trust the average American citizen and any kind of constraint or restraint they can put on them, they can't wait to do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with you, monkeys. I think that if you follow what happened in South Korea, and if you follow in China now and I say that with a caveat, and the caveat is this: like, if you believe the numbers the Chinese are putting out, you're stupid. Right?
Yeah,
I will say that. I just, based on everything I've seen, medical people who don't have a political axe to grind. You know, they believe that, you know, we haven't been able to test, so there's more people that are out there that have it. I don't know that that's particularly crying Chicken Little. Now, I've seen politicians go on and they say this, I don't want to make this political, but, right? And then you're like, oh, my God.
And well, so, I mean, I think normally 150,000 people die every day. What they used to call World War One, that's normal wastage. And so the totals don't add up to the panic that people are trying to, I think, stoke.
And if you don't have a random sample of the population where you're checking for the prevalence of this particular bug, and you're able to repeat that random sample a few and further off in time, you don't know the we have the numerator, number of deaths. We don't know the denominator. And the denominator, I suspect, is huge, to include Jeff, to include my wife, who had the exact same symptoms over Christmas, as did a ton of people down here in the valley. And I think when that denominator, that huge denominator, comes out, you're looking at a virus that is not that deadly, with the exception to the elderly and those who have pre-existing conditions. But all flu viruses are deadly to the elderly and those who have pre-existing conditions. And so I don't think the president has a choice, because the experts are saying this is the worst case scenario and it's prudent to prepare for it. But it matches a tabletop exercise that these same experts did in October. And I don't think that the disease is mimicking what they had projected it's going to mimic. And they're working off of models that they know to be inaccurate, because using models to predict future events is always a hit and miss. It's very rarely that accurate. It just gives you a left and right lateral limit. If what I suspect is true, it's good news. It means that this is going to weather. But I'm telling you, in the next 2 weeks, if you don't see a gigantic increase in people dying from bilateral pneumonia, from viral pneumonia, and we've seen no increase in that I'm aware of, although we wouldn't know really, because lots of those deaths would go unreported from nursing homes and what have you. They don't autopsy every person that dies in those places. But I suspect you're not going to see that. And when you don't see that, there's going to be a hell of a lot of people asking some questions here.
But Timmy, you're along with what he's saying. You know that they would be very liberal with their extrapolation of the fact that yes, there is more pneumonia and stuff. You know, the slightest excuse they could to kind of connect those dots, they would.
Yeah, and I suspect if there's a bunch of people under the age of 50 showing up and dying in the hospitals with bilateral viral pneumonia, we would have been hearing about that as it was occurring, because that's unusual. That gets people's attention. And
it's like
we haven't
been a lot
heard anything. There's no bodies.
A lot of examples of Michael Methuselah passing away at 95, tragically, when he would have passed away at 95 and a half otherwise. And there's no Brian Piccolos in this story. No Brian Piccolos. There's no,
Brian, that stuff. Brian Piccolo. Holy shit.
Yeah, you know, there was. That Chinese doctor that died would be the Brian Piccolo. But again, we're not seeing anything like that. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. My daily routine is not altered one bit. Apparently, I was social isolating long before this was even a thing, because I go to the gym, I go to the store, not anymore because the stores are way too crowded. I might go to the bank and that's it. So yeah. It makes no impact on my life whatsoever. But I am just worried about the economic impact, because I don't think we can calculate how bad it's going to get, because it is screwing people over. This not working stuff.
It's amazing how anxious, these Democratic politicians, all the Democratic politicians and half the Republican ones are always willing to say in a deep, funereal like voices, we're going to have to shut all the restaurants and all the bars. And, and that's a whole industry of people who are working. They just put out of work callously. They could give a shit,
And that's the last point that I made in my article. This seems to me to be very similar to virtue signaling. When the New York governor of New York can announce all these draconian things, not a one bit of fallout is going to affect him. He'll never have to worry about getting his money. He doesn't have to worry about getting access to treatment. He doesn't have to worry about people panic buying and he can't get any toilet paper. He doesn't have to worry about any of this. There's no skin in the game for a lot of these officials that are making these draconian calls. And that just irks me on principle alone.
So what would you guys have done given what you've seen?
I would have done the same thing that genius, wonderful leader President Obama did for SARS and did for the big diseases that came when he was president. Nothing.
Nothing. All right.
Nothing. See what happens.
Timmy, nothing?
It depends on what level we're talking about. The governor here in Texas said he's not ordering the restaurants to close. I think that's eminently reasonable. There's only so much the government officials can do right now to withstand this tsunami of activity. I mean, as soon as the Ivy League canceled their sports season, nobody else was going to be able to have their season. It was a foregone conclusion, because who's going to ignore the experts? And I think that, again, the experts might have been a little bit wrong and calling wolf this time. But what can a politician do to withstand the pressure? You have to do something. Well, let's close the schools and send the kids home. Was it really a good idea to have the kids mixing up with all the old people and everybody else? I mean, around here in the Rio Grande Valley, the families here are gigantic, and they all include for the most part include live-in grandparents and relatives. Having all the kids running in and out of the house around with those old people, is it going to keep them safer or expose them to more? Are we risking the herd immunity of our school children because they were all isolated as this thing was burning through the population? There's a lot of downsides to these things, but nobody talks about the downsides.
I know, but hold on. The question was, if you were queen for a day, what would you have done?
As long as I'm queen, I will appoint myself governor of Texas. I would mimic what the current governor is doing, although I would talk down the panic response. I would make it a point to be seen in public all the time, talking to people, saying, hey, look, at the very worst, it's a 2% infection rate, for crying out loud. Come on, man. Yeah. Only 3% of the people in Wuhan got sick from this virus. The rest of them are apparently immune. So I would be out there talking up our response and encouraging neighbors to look out for each other, because there's only so much you can do to resist the tsunami of overreaction that has washed over our country.
Yeah.
I contend behind the yeah, the Mexicans want to close the border to keep it out of their country.
They're not stupid.
Yeah.
Right. No, I don't think you have any choice. You've got to react. But I think we've way overreacted, and that a lot more of our politicians should be calming people the fuck down, because it's ridiculous. I can't go to the store and buy toilet paper now. It really chaps my ass. Ha! Huh? I just thought of that. That's great. Thank you.
No pun intended. I think it's a pretty interesting study in terms of one of the things that, you know, that I got to, you know, when I started doing my decision-making stuff, one of the things that is really, you have to teach people to learn to live with as a military decision-maker is uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. And you are going to feel like you don't have enough information to make this decision.
Right.
And in the midst of that, you've got to make a lucid decision. You've got to articulate the order, right? And you've got to make it go. And then you got to keep your head in the game to find out if the assumptions you made are right or wrong. If they're wrong, then you got to tweak it and you got to evolve it to win. You know, and then because really for politicians, the whole thing is anchored on liability, right? And college presidents. And so you go into a room and you close the doors and the lawyers are sitting there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Look, all I know is this. If we don't do this and somebody gets sick, they're going to sue our asses off and we're going to be liable for millions of dollars. And we're going to be liable for millions of dollars for every person like that. So
these guys don't have much confidence in their own abilities.
Right. How does anybody talk the president of a university? And, you know, I mean, the Ivy League, they cancel everything, right? Not only winter, but all spring sports too, that are just underway. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, we're going to cancel. It's like, you don't know that yet. And it's amazing. The governor of California yesterday is talking about, yeah, schools are probably not going to open. It's fucking March, man. I mean,
yeah.
if some of the things that Dr. Fauci is saying are true, and the president, you know, halting, you know, flights from Asia in January, right, gave the nation time. And now, we're seeing, you know, the test kits come and the drive-through testing happen and all the rest of this stuff. And if the country is successful in blunting that spike, then we're not going to – kids are done with school in March and they're not going to go back. They're not going to make any attempt. I mean, to me, all that is indicative of inexperienced decision makers who aren't comfortable staying in their lane and who aren't comfortable with uncertainty, because it's a different form of decision making.
Well, to them, failure isn't really, you know, like people get the disease or don't get the disease. People is a perception that's propagated by the media, which emanates from the Ivy League. Oh, which, by the way, biggest endowment, contributor to the Ivy League is the communist Chinese government. You know, so it's like, I smell a rat.
The biggest? Are you sure about the biggest?
Yes. Well, maybe the United States government is bigger, but I mean, the biggest contributor besides the U.S. government is the fucking Chinese.
Well, wait a minute. How did they get into our coronavirus decision-making loop here in the United States?
Well, they have influence over the Ivy League.
Oh, they picked up the phone and called the Ivy League and said, shut that shit down?
No.
Maybe
that's what they do.
Well, look what they do at the NBA over Hong Kong.
Yeah.
They're perfectly capable of that shit.
I don't think they need to call up that Harvard professor who was arrested. What was he, the head of physics at Harvard? Mm-hmm. I don't think they need to call up and give him marching
He's
orders.
In jail.
I think given the millions and millions of dollars that are flowing into their bank accounts.
They had him on speed dial, okay?
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying about dynamic decision-making in that? And that you see, and as you said, once one goes – now I'm going to be the guy who's standing here telling everybody. But I will tell you what, the DOD has not closed its schools down in Japan. They're like the lone beacon. Like, no, we have not had any cases. We monitor it every day. CDC has a decision-making matrix. We go by that, and that's how we make decisions here.
And that's reasonable.
Right.
FedEx guy was talking about FedEx employees in Wuhan province,
right,
in the middle of all this thing. They had, like, I don't know, 70 or 80 people in there in Wuhan who lived there. You know, they're Americans, but they work in there. And four of them were identified with the virus. Two of them turned out to be they were false readings. And the other two weathered the virus and are now, you know, recovered. Nobody else got it. And so it's like,
well, no, it's Fred Smith, right? Talking about CEO, former Marine, and the CEO of FedEx, talking about, you know, we've been deemed critical infrastructure around the world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're trying to sustain operations in Italy, in Europe, in China, you know, everywhere. And so, you know, we're learning as a business how to do this. But again, the Chicken Little stuff. And then again, the other thing, it's only exacerbated by the media who can't blow it up enough. And so to me, but I'm with you, Timmy. It hasn't impacted me. It hasn't impacted me in my hermit life of doing All Marine Radio here in writing. Right. Now I have my daughter, Colleen, who I have a workout partner now. So Colleen lives with me and runs with me. And I guess we're going to be buddies here for a few months, but it has not impacted my life either. Jeff interacts with the most humans.
I go into work every day.
Yeah, we don't. I just get up and shower and come into the studio and start working. So Jeff, is it weird? Do people act different when somebody coughs? Does everybody go to general quarters?
Well, the office is pretty much deserted. We're still doing ranges for these this team we got on deck now.
Right.
Like, they're doing, you know, tables 3 and 4. You know, basically, for those who don't know, it's just basic rifle and pistol stuff. The rest of the people, like, I was I stood in the conference room because now, instead of having all the G shop leaders, like the colonel in charge of training, the colonel in charge of the intel, so they have them all go to the MEF headquarters building now. They have them sit in place, and they civets them. There's a conference. So if the guy 300 yards away, you have a telephone conference with him, or not telephone, but a video conference with him instead of going up and actually seeing him. So...
Oh God! We are the most politically correct military there's ever been. I swear to God, we can suck up like nobody's business in our. It's unbelievable.
We have
so
to.
I went
what
to the
about,
VA
what about showing some fortitude?
Dental.
Damn it!
I went from the MEF to the VA, and then when I got into the VA, they have little kiosks set up now, like outside the Naval Hospital on base.
Yeah.
And in front of the VA, a little kiosk set up where there's a dude there who's dressed like somebody in, you know, St. Elsewhere with a surgical mask on. He says, "Sir, can I ask you a couple of questions? Sir, are you feeling feverish? Are you feeling..." I'm fine. I don't have any fevers or anything like that. And I don't want to hurt myself or others. I just got to go in and see him about dental. Okay. All right, sir, go ahead. Let me see your ID card. You can go in. This guy's got a mask on, you know? But it's the same thing when you go to the hospital. I went in to pick up Lori's prescription yesterday. Exact same scenario. So, but other than that, everything's pretty... It's like they shut down the rear gate, the gate you go into Camp Del Mar, which is like my most convenient gate. So everyone has to go through the main gate now.
Oh,
Monday, that was a pain in the ass.
That sucks.
But then today it was like driving into Atlanta and the land in the Walking Dead. You know what I mean? There's like only one gate open and no one's trying to get in or out. So.
Yeah, that's not. Yeah, that's tough, man. That parking thing. Holy shit. All right, I want to ask you another thing that I've been kind of tracking that we've talked about. We've talked about the United States and Iran and when Iran attacked Saudi oil production facilities, we said the most dangerous course of action for the United States was to do nothing. Iran is the nation that's been hit hardest per capita with the coronavirus thing. I mean, they've had senior people in their administration, you know, die already. They have the largest percentage of their population impacted. And you see reports almost on a daily basis from Iranian medical professionals saying, we're lying about the numbers, too. The numbers are higher. And they did not shut down holy sites. And I believe it's the Shiite New Year coming up or something like that, one of their holidays. And so four times in the last week, the United States has been hit by rockets. Taji's been hit twice. And then a training base south of Baghdad got hit yesterday. And then last night, the Green Zone near the American Embassy got rocketed as well. The United States responded after the initial attack in which Americans were killed. The United States has not retaliated in the subsequent three attacks, only the first of which, so it would have been attack number two, on that attack, I think wounded, I want to say four or five coalition soldiers, if I'm not mistaken. What do you make of that? And so my take is this. I believe the United States is assessing somewhere in some agency that Iran is desperate for the great Satan to show up and rescue it, because not only has it had to deal with, you know, the Soleimani hit and being stuck back in its cage really by the United States, they went to Europe for sanction relief. They got nothing from that. Their economy is completely on the skids. They had an election. They had the lowest turnout since 1979. And now it seems like they baited the great Satan, because this coronavirus thing, this COVID-19 thing, is blowing up inside of Iran, and the people are looking at us, and this is now going to be heaped on everything else. I believe in my mind that makes sense, that we would restrain our response because of all that. So, Jeff, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. I think that when they do those little like pinprick attacks, against Taji and then the training base south of Baghdad there, it's a sign of desperation. They're wanting us to do something. They'll take people's mind in Iran off the incompetence of their government. First of all, to deal with the sanctions, and now to deal with the coronavirus, which is a direct result of their chummy relationship with the Chinese. And hopefully someone is being prudent and saying, hey, look, we got this big, huge President Trump type thing planned that we can pull the trigger on. But right now, us doing not much is really paying off for us when it comes to this inside Iran itself.
Timmy?
I agree with the assessment that Iran is definitely trying to get a response on us, something that they could once again point to as us overreacting. But from listening to CENTCOM talk that you had on the show a couple of days ago, I'm not comfortable with how we're responding to those things. I have said probably since you guys knew me in IOC that there's a big difference between sending a missile to take somebody out and sending a bunch of dudes in the middle of the night to slit their throats. And so I'm not advocating for throat slitting necessarily, but what I'm saying is there's a big difference between when there's men coming down, kicking down a door and taking your people out. That sends a different kind of message. And I think that kind of message means we're serious. And I would be most gratified to see us start launching punitive raids rather than missiles.
Yeah. Well, you know, something else, it would really be ballsy, but we practice it so much and it never, you know, it never comes to fruition is an actual, you know, VBSS where we just grab three of their tankers. That's a huge amount of money they're going to be out. And we don't give them
wait,
back.
Wait. So when you're talking about their tankers, what are you talking about?
Oil tankers on their way out to Europe. And, you know, so we basically mess with them in a almost, you know, a minimum of violence, but it's a way that puts even more misery on as far as, you know, economically. And so it's a type of thing that you want to be, you don't want to get everybody, you know, in Iran all fired up and deciding that, you know, the mullahs are great because they're against the great Satan and that. So any response, I think, can be measured that way because it is paying off. I mean, the fact that they're suffering in so many fronts, I think is resulting in unrest within the country that they have to deal with. And just having to deal with it makes them less effective at doing malfeasance around the globe, particularly in that area.
Yeah, the Israelis just reported, I want to say the day before yesterday, that Iranian shit-disturbing, for lack of a better term, has declined across the region. And the Israeli says we don't expect that it will stay like that. Right. However, they are certainly, after the Suleiman hit, they are certainly internally preoccupied. And now after the downing of the civilian airliner, and then they lied to the Iranian people, and then the Soleimani protest turned into an anti-government protest because that all kind of blew up at once. And now this layered on top of it. The Israelis assessed that they are struggling. I believe, though, I just find it interesting that I think that somebody believes that, you know, we're heading for regime change there. And, I mean, one can only hope, but I was just curious about your thoughts.
Hey, I've got a COA off of what Jeff just said. Imagine every time they send one of their tankers out, we pull it over, send a British boarding party because they're so polite and they don't say fuck or anything, right? And you start citing them for not having enough life jackets, for having inappropriate survival gear. Basically, you give them like a Coast Guard ticket, say, nope, you've got to return to your port of origin. You can't transit the ocean. I mean, this is obviously like a psychological operation, but goddamn, that would be funny. Every tanker they send out, you got to send back to port. Say, sorry, dude, you're not safe. You don't have the requirements for a ship of the sea. I'd love to see us do
is
something like that.
Is there a maritime highway patrol?
No. We'd be winging it.
We'd have to start one, then pull them over.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you did, you want to have the Brits doing the interface with the customer because they're so damn polite and they never cuss. They're awesome, yeah. Sort of like that.
Or the Emiratis. Yeah.
Did you – let me – here's another one from the Middle East. Did you see that an Iraqi Shiite was named as the prime minister and tasked with forming a government? He used to live in the United States. Do you see that?
Yeah.
I did not.
I mean, that should be good. I mean, you know, especially if he lives in the United States and he doesn't hate us.
Well, you know, it's good when the Iranian-backed militias there all reacted, you know,
negatively.
Negatively. Yeah. You're like, oh, holy
shit.
We are
not amused.
They were not amused, to say the least. But it's interesting in that he's the second person nominated to that position. The first one could not form a government. And so is this a better attempt at it? I just wondered if you guys saw that. Any thoughts on that, Jeff?
I think that's encouraging. You know, that really is. And that it's encouraging because it seems like they're catering to the will of the majority of the people there. And
well, that's what was written, that he would govern in a secular way, which is when you if you've read about, you know, somebody at some point uniting Iraq, yeah. that Iraq needs a leader like that will yeah. be fair with everybody, and that would
well,
be Saddam, the person.
Yeah, like Saddam was fair with everybody. He was brutal to
yeah,
everybody.
Brutal to everybody, right.
And he had representatives. He had Christian guy. He had, you know, he had Kurds and Shia and, you know, Sunni. But, to be non-facetious, I hope so. After all the blood and treasure we put into that place, to have one of them not actually go to shit, you know, would be good for sure.
All right, let me read you. I want to read you an email somebody sent to me.
Okay.
I got this a few days ago. The title is John Bradley Flag Raiser. Bradley was extremely dishonest for not coming clean right away. He knew, and the word knew is all caps, he wasn't in the picture. He totally dishonored Harold Schultz, knowingly or unknowingly. Your thoughts on that?
I disagree. I don't think putting up that flag meant jack shit to any of them until after the picture came out. So I'm thinking maybe I was in it, maybe I wasn't. I don't fucking know, you know?
Go. I know what I wanted to tell you guys in keeping with this. And Timmy, first of all, before we get to Timmy's opinion, I downloaded this son of a bitch today. Where is it? It is a 400-page PDF that the Marine Corps put out, the Marine Corps Historical Division put out, and it is everything you've ever thought about reading about Iwo Jima.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it just came out within the last last year.
Maybe. I got to get that. And listen to this, Max. On Friday the 27th, I'm doing an Iwo Jima presentation for Bronze in the 15th MU Command Element. So because the Commandant said he wants every 06 command to have an event honoring Iwo Jima between the 19th of February 2020 and the actual end of the battle, which is the 26th. But because of the international dateline, we're going to do it on Friday the 27th. I mean, right now it's still there. Everything else, all other type of things over 10 people are being canceled. But
I will send you this, and you'll
that'd be great.
You guys will love it. It's called Investigating Iwo, and the subtitle is The Flag Raisings in Myth, Memory, and Esprit de Corps. And let me just read you some of the sections in this. It's and I heard about it in during an interview. Part one, In the Cauldron of War. Chapter one is written by Charles Niemeyer. He's a former director of Marine Corps Historical Division.
Right.
It's called Black Sand and Blood, The 36-Day Battle of Iwo Jima. Chapter two, Going to Tojo's Front Door by Colonel Douglas Nash from the Marine Corps Historical Division. Chapter 3, Time, Life, and Flag Raisings on Iwo Jima, Dr. Melissa Wren, the Harvard Business School. Chapter 4, Flag Raisings, Raising Funds, Promoting the Mighty Seventh War Loan, Dr. Austin Porter from Kenyon College. Part 2, Memory and Meaning. Chapter 5, Did Joe Rosenthal Save the Marine Corps? The Existential Fight from 1943 to 52 by Dr. David W. Mills, U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. So you can see this is like not light intellectual, coffee table picture book, right?
Right.
But it's awesome. Politics and the Art of Portraiture, Felix de Weldon's Marine Corps War Memorial. Chapter 7, Another Country's Flag, Another Country's Servicemen, Rosenthal's Photograph and Commemoration of the U.S. Marine Corps in Australia and New Zealand.
Wow.
Chapter 8, How the Iwo Jima Memorial Became a Personal Mortuary Monument for My Japanese Mother, Dr. Yi Suzuki from the University of Maryland. So there's all kinds of cool shit. And then at the end, right, is Recovering the Past, A Flag for Suribachi, The First and Forgotten Flag Raising on Iwo Jima, written by Stephen Foley and Dustin Pence, And those are the two amateur historians who really were the impetus behind all of this. Chapter 10, supplied flag to Marines to fly on Mount Suribachi, confirming the role of LST-779 in the second flag raising by Christopher Halvern, Naval History and Heritage Command. Chapter 11, Janos motion picture footage, lost in the line of duty by Chris Austin of the National Archives and Records Administration. Chapter 12, Correcting the Record, the Hewley Panel Looks at the Iwo Jima Flag Raisings by Mary Reinwald, Colonel Tite.
Is that General Hewley they're talking about?
Yeah, Jan Hewley.
Yeah.
You want to get on his bad side.
Oh, well, you can tell us that in a second. And then Chapter 13 is the last. No, I'm sorry. Chapter 13, In Fairness to All Parties, the Marine Corps Corrects a Historical Record by Kyle Gentry. Do you guys know Kyle?
Yeah.
Kyle. Yeah,
I don't believe I do.
Yeah, he's an awesome. He's a great guy. And in that he talks about going to talking to Gagnon's son, talking to Bradley's son, talking to Corporal Keller's daughter, and then talking to the way they did this was they'd go to the VFW. Are there guys that were there that were buddies of his that are still alive? And he'd get names and. Kyle Gentry would go call these guys up and they'd go visit them, you know, and then go to the local historical society. Do you guys have anything on Corporal Keller? Did he write letters? And it's just, I start looking at this thing. And this is how, just so everybody knows, this is how we are. I see this thing, I clicked to download it because I saw it on one of the searches I did. And I clicked download it, but nothing materializes in the PDF screen on my computer. And I'm like, well, I wonder if it's just empty. And so an hour later, I go back and I all of a sudden I notice it, and it says Investigating Iwo. And I'm like, what? And I look, and it's it's 401 pages. So wow. Like an idiot, I derail my whole day by starting to scroll through it. And then I can't fucking stop. I can't stop. And at one point, you know, they talk about John Bradley. You know, so why, right? So Bradley gets he's wounded, right, in both legs.
Yeah,
he's right. Recovering in Hawaii. They show him this newspaper and they say, "Hey Bradley, you're in this picture. You're going to DC." And he's like whatever. And it's one of those like newspaper pictures, like you can't see shit. So he flies there and he gets there, and this public information lieutenant colonel looks at Bradley and says, "Doc, you're in this picture, right?" And evidently Bradley balks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "I don't know. Like, I mean, I was up there that day. I mean, but who the fuck remembers?" Like, right? And everybody's acting like, well, you know, to include this email. And so as they treat this subject of Bradley, Bradley doesn't say I wasn't in it, right? Keller doesn't say I was in it, and Schultz doesn't say I was in it. So
they don't remember, man.
Well, either they don't remember, but back in the day they did not want that kind of attention, right?
Yeah, right. That's true, yeah.
And so Bradley gets told, "Doc, your name's already been released to the public. Okay, you've been named by two other guys as in this picture. That's you, right? And we need you on this war bond drive." And, like, okay. Now, Bradley thinks, "I'm going to go on this war bond drive, and this thing's going to be over, right?"
Yeah.
And so
it's a nightmare. It doesn't end.
Yeah. And it never fucking ends, right? And it never ends. And so, you know, but if you look at the long arc of every one of those guys' lives, they lived them with honor, right?
Yeah.
They came back and they were productive people. Bradley's a great guy in his community.
Right.
So anyway, so I kind of sent a note, and I emailed Mary Reinwald and said, "Hey, I know there's a footnote to the conversation where Bradley gets essentially told to shut up and color." She said, "I have it at work, but we're not at work right now. So when I go back next week, I'll send it to you." So, but you guys, I'll send you the link to this. You guys will love it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Timmy, you didn't get a chance to give your opinion about Bradley and your thoughts on that.
No, I think particularly after you've explained it all, and by the way, I've downloaded that thing. You should see some of the pictures in this thing, Jeff.
I've never seen it.
It's awesome.
Yeah,
yeah. But I think that Bradley was. I think it's just like you said. But what a horrible position, because you know, yeah. I mean, we all know how we wore a deuce gear. You can look and see right. a picture of me. I would think I could pick myself out of a crowd without. Just on basis of my gear, right? Because it's so individualized. So he had to know eventually. And
but see, here's what I think about that, Timmy. It's like they show him the grainy picture and they get him. And now we go on the war bond drive, right? And we're sitting there and we're going through these things. And now they've blown the son of a bitch up. And I'm looking at it.
Right.
Right? And I'm thinking at some point somebody's going to see my uniform and they're going to know that ain't fucking me. Right, yeah. And you're yeah. looking at it, and so to me, it's probably at some point during the war bond drive when Bradley sees that son of a bitch, bigger, like 18 stories tall, and goes, "How the fuck do none of these morons know in another picture that you know that I wasn't wearing wire cutters and I had those Unit 1 things always on me, and my fucking pants were cuffed, and I always wore my leggings? None of these morons figured it out. Come on."
Yeah.
And then it was like,
they still want to make waves.
Right. You know what? And to me, so the first thing I did was I emailed him back. I said, well, do you hold Keller and Schultz to the same standard? Because they didn't tell the truth either. And he said, oh, no. They were just humble. They were just humble guys. And I said, oh, but Bradley's a piece of shit. So,
but he didn't use that to benefit himself.
Ever.
And that's why he gets the break. He gets the All Marine Radio break. We officially administer to him.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So
whatever they do, the new Catholics.
I don't think his son even knew he had the Navy Cross until after he got sick.
Oh yeah, and he found it. And what about Gagnon? Do you give Gagnon the same pass? Gagnon said he was in the picture, and interestingly enough, they can't definitely place Gagnon in the gung-ho picture, which was everybody.
Yeah,
they can't place him in that picture, and if he wasn't in the flag raising, there's not a picture of him. And so what the report concludes is we cannot definitively place Gagnon, because what they were looking for was any picture of Gagnon up on top so they could compare uniforms, and they can't find one.
Yeah, he's a runner. He's a runner. He's a guy running back and forth between Chandler Johnson.
Right.
And, you know, the guys in Hill. So
and he can't. And they look for any picture of Gagnon on Iwo Jima and can't find it because they're saying, look, everybody's uniform stayed relatively the same, so he's going to, like, wear it the same way. And one of the ways the FBI matched people was by the camouflage pattern on their helmets.
Yeah.
Crazy. Uh-huh. Yeah. What angle it sat on your hat, on your helmet, and how, you know, and how you wore that. That was one of the defining characteristics that they used as they digitized these pictures and blew them up, right, hugely. And the FBI used their software and some of their facial recognition shit. Mm-hmm. They identify Mike Strank because Strank wears his field jacket over another jacket they wore. And everybody else wore theirs opposite, and Strank wears his the other way around. And that's because you can't see Strank's face in the picture.
Right.
And so it's really interesting. But there's no picture of Gagnon up there. So the conclusion is he went up there with the second flag, but Johnson's order was get that first flag before somebody steals the son of a bitch.
That's our flag.
Right, right. Right.
And then they would have taken – Gagnon would have left when the second flag goes up, first flag comes down, right, simultaneously when you see the videos, right? They take the first flag off, you know. Gagnon grabs it and he goes down the hill and he's not there for even the gung ho photo. So it's really interesting. And as Timmy said, the pictures in it are different angles and stuff that you've never seen. Some from private collections that I didn't even know existed.
Yeah.
Oh man. And I'm thumbing through this damn thing, and here's a picture of DeWeldon making the sculpture of Gamelin right there, Renee Gamelin himself.
I thought of you guys when I saw it.
Holy shit, man, that is something.
There's a picture of Mike Strank too, where they say, you know, he wore his what do they say? Although Sergeant Mike Strank's face is partially, if not completely, obscured in all known photographs of the second flag raising, his particular uniform layering assisted the Bowers board. So there's two Hewley boards, and then the Bowers boards is the final board where Keller's named, in confirming his presence in AP photographer Joe Rosenthal's famous photograph. And there's a picture of Mike Strank standing there with his thumbs in his pockets. Yeah. And, right. And the way that he wore the bill of his soft cover, wore it bent. And, so it's really, I mean, and then the way that the FBI determines every one of those dudes is pretty impressive. So.
Hey, and getting into this kind of detail during the great hunkering down in America, this is the kind of stuff that people need to hear. Because you can spend hours going through this crap.
Oh, my God.
And we've got the time now, apparently.
Yeah.
This is fascinating.
Well, the one guy who they identify by face, and this is the picture that I hadn't seen, and it's once from straight in front when they're putting the in the second flag raising. It's like, and you could see, you know, Harold Keller's face, like, poof. Yeah, they said, yeah, Keller, we identify with facial recognition software, clearly. You're like, damn, where did that picture come from, man? And it's such a different picture. You could see Hayes in the background. Mm-hmm. You see, who's the guy in front? Is it Block or Sousley? One of them moved.
Sousley, right?
Yeah.
One of his asses. That's how his mom recognized him, by his ass.
Right. And then there's another picture of them, you know, kind of – at the top that I'd never seen before. So anyway, but I just, you know, to me, Bradley is a tragic figure because, I mean, he's a Navy Cross recipient. I remember reading something that Chuck Lindbergh wrote, who was a corporal.
Right. Flamethrower guy. Silver Star guy.
So yeah. And Lindbergh said, I got shot and I went down, but it was a through and through shot through my bicep. And I knew I was okay, right? You know, I got the million-dollar wound. And Bradley saw me go down, and I screamed at him, no, Doc, don't come. And he said, it didn't matter. He said, if John Bradley saw you go down, he was coming. And so, but it is interesting, right? The nobody had a Twitter account. Nobody's saying, hey, check it out, man, I'm in this picture. And in fact, everybody's avoiding the attention. And then the Keller guy, you know, Corporal Keller, he never says anything to anybody. And then after all this is done, right, and he's named, his daughter evidently is going through old papers and then sends Kyle Gentry a letter that you see as an enclosure at the end of it. And what she says is, it's a letter from her mother to her sister saying that Harold said he had a hand in raising the flag on Iwo Jima. And it's the only reference to him, you know, having a part in it. So pretty cool stuff. Pretty cool stuff. But Bradley. And all right, what's on your mind? Anything?
No, only to say that about the Iwo thing. That was like the most – all the guys who survived that, they don't look at it as like a big stirring victory. It was a crushing, horrific experience. I mean, it's the worst battle we ever fought, you know. And besides being totally wiped out, you couldn't think of a worse way to spend 36 days or three hours, let alone that. You know, than being on that island. So my hat's off to those guys for sure.
No, and all of them, right? Ira Hayes tells Gagnon, if you tell people I'm in that picture, I'll kill you.
Yeah, right.
Right? And Gagnon wouldn't give up Ira Hayes' name, right? And why? Because he believed him.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's funny.
He believed it. Timmy, final thought?
No, brother. I'm just, I guess the next 2 weeks we'll see whether this thing is as bad as everybody's predicting. I say for the rest of us, the just to remain calm and carry on the plan of the day.
Well, look, you've seen all those memes, right? That says, you know, the greatest generation, you know, fought Germany and Japan for 4 years at the cost of, you know, what was it, 400,000 American lives.
Yeah.
You know, post 9/11, you know, we've had, you know, 1% of the population go fight for, you know, almost 20 years.
Right.
And now your battle is going to be stay at home and wash your hands. So, I mean, if you follow that advice, right, you know, like 99% of us are going to be okay. If you don't want to follow that advice, then I guess you'll. But to me, you know, the thing, one of the things I talked about yesterday on the program was, you know, we have mechanisms to account for unemployment. And to me, I think if the government says we got to close down all the restaurants and we got to do this and that, then those people ought to get their wages, you know, continue right. to be paid. And we can do that through the unemployment office. Go down, file your claim. This is how much I made. And then we fund whatever percentage.
You're right. And then there's no new bureaucracy that has
yeah,
been made.
But let me tell you know, Jeff's still getting paid. I'm still getting paid. Tim's still getting his retirement. Right? We don't need $1,000 each.
Right.
And so,
that's exactly right.
And so to me, there's smarter ways to do some of the things that I've heard people talk about. And the same mm-hmm. thing with, you know, with you know, when your town gets wiped out by a disaster – you know, one of the great misnomers is, you know, the federal government shows up and gives you money. They don't give you money, right? They'll you know, FEMA shows up and you can have loans for cheap.
Right.
And it's kind of a stunner when it happens because everybody believes that, like, yeah, the federal government comes. The federal government will come and give the city and county money. And then 10 years later, they come back and they audit what you spent every dime of it on. And if you didn't spend it, if you spent it on existing damage, you have to pay the federal government back.
Yeah.
And so to me, you know, if you have a business and the government shuts it down, the government should make zero interest loans available to you. And then I do believe it's appropriate, you know, that the government writes off a part of that loan, whether it's 50% or 75%. People can argue about that
right.
and whatnot. But, I mean, you can't go to work. You can't do – wait a minute. If I have a landscaping company – right, I got to go to work, man.
Yeah.
Got to feed my kids. I got to pay my rent. And so I think I'm hopeful that cooler heads prevail.
Yeah.
And we target that money to help people that have been thrown out of work that you know, 2 weeks ago were living their lives and everything was good.
Yeah, so, big government assholes already rubbing their hands together.
Yeah.
About how they can get more shit out of this. You're right.
Right.
Use existing bureaucracy for sure.
And I was just going to add, when you're talking about using the existing mechanisms of unemployment, those are all state-run programs, not right. federal-run programs. And so if the federal government is giving the state of Texas, I wanted $1,000 for each unemployment claim filed, in Texas you could reasonably assume that the $1,000 will find a way to the claimants. But there's not a chance in hell of that happening in Illinois.
Right.
Not that people are going to steal it. It's just the way those systems are set up with all the bureaucracies and the way that money winds their way through them. So,
the only thing I'd say to me, I agree. I don't disagree with you. But what I'd say is the kind of visibility this thing has now, I think would hopefully make that hard to do. I have to tell you this. One thing I want both you guys to go look at is, and Jeff, I put the link in our little chat window,
okay.
But on page 222 in something that Kyle Gentry wrote, in figure 13.2 is a picture I've never seen before. And it is a picture of from kind of down the slope a little bit as they're tightening up the second flag after it's been raised. And there's two Marines, right? There's two Marines that are saluting as they're putting the flag in the ground.
Wow.
On top of fucking Iwo Jima with a whole bunch of Japanese dudes running around in the ground underneath them.
Oh, I see it. I see it. Yeah. Whoa, cool.
No, it's just, right? It's a statement about who they were.
Yeah.
Right? And it's First Lieutenant Harold Schreier. And it's his.
Oh, he's
a platoon commander.
The, the patrol leader who took them all up there. Yeah.
Right. And it's and his platoon sergeant, Boots Thomas.
Yeah.
And they're saluting. They're standing on top of the rim. The picture's being taken from below it. And you see the guys from the second flag raising still messing with the pole. And they're standing there saluting.
I think that guy Schreier was a company commander in 5th Marines during the Chosen campaign. He got another – he's highly decorated guy, Navy Cross Silver – I mean, through Korea, too. He retired in, like, 66 or 67. Yeah.
I listened to General Davis and some stuff he did.
Yeah.
Holy shit, man. He talked about his Medal of Honor and – he was a battalion commander of 1-7.
1-7, right.
And they're on the far side of the
Tak Tong Pass.
And he got told, hey, you gotta go relieve Captain Barber's company, right?
Fox Company.
And he said the units that had tried to go down the road got hammered, so he went through the mountains, and he describes the whole thing. It's awesome.
Yeah, he was like crazy with fatigue. Him and Lee, Lieutenant Chu En Lee, who made a fucking uniform out of air panels so everybody could see him, did the navigation through the mountains. And by the time they almost got there, he's talking to the battalion commander, and they're both almost drunk from the fatigue of it, you know, and the bitter cold. It's a pretty good story, man.
Harold Schreier.
Yeah. I think it was Echo 2-5, if I'm not mistaken.
Born on October 17th, 1916, and he died June 3rd, 1971. A United States Marine Corps lieutenant colonel, served in World War II in Korea. During the Battle of Iwo Jima, he led the 40-man patrol to the top of Mount Suribachi and helped raise the first of two United States flags. He received the Navy Cross, the nation's second highest military award for valor. He was wounded in North Korea at the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir. He fought at Midway?
Yeah.
Guadalcanal?
Coastal defense guy.
Yeah, Guadalcanal, New Georgia, Bougainville, and Iwo Jima. He fights at the Pusan Perimeter, at Incheon, and the Chosin Reservoir. Navy Cross, Silver Star, Legion of Merit with a Combat V, Bronze Star with a Combat V, Purple Heart, and a Combat Action Ribbon times two. Mm-hmm. And, like, what's wrong?
And that's the defense medal.
Yeah, and that dude becomes a lieutenant colonel? What the fuck's wrong with that picture?
I know it.
Maybe he got sideways with somebody.
Yeah.
How the fuck does he not make colonel at least? Holy shit. Schreier was promoted to major in May of 1951 and was the officer in charge of the Marine Corps recruiting station in Birmingham, Alabama. After he was a provost marshal of Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego, he retired from the Marine Corps as lieutenant colonel in 1957. The year of my birth. He died at a hospital in Bradenton, Florida in 1971. He's buried in Mansion Memorial Park in Ellenton, Florida. Jeff, the next time you go.
I will.
You got to go check him out. Hey, let me just tell you something.
He was actually in the movie, Sanzi Iwo Jima, playing himself.
His Navy Cross is for the Iwo Jima, the Suribachi. Right. Event.
Yeah, but that shit don't matter if you don't make mission on recruiting duty, man.
Can you imagine?
Times you miss mission one day, you're a cocksucker forever.
And believe me, I was a cocksucker for six forever. and let me tell you, he had too many bravos. That's why he never made colonel.
Like your briefing is package at the colonel's board, right? And you go down the list. Okay, let me tell you about Lieutenant Colonel Schreier, Battle of Midway, Battle of Guadalcanal, Battle of New Georgia, Bougainville, leads the 40-man platoon, plants a flag, Pusan Perimeter, Incheon, and Chosin. Yeah. Get to what he's done, okay? Like, who is this guy? What is he? Like, are you shitting me? Look, I don't know what he's up for, but he's got my vote.
No shit. Well, you got colonels like Colonel fucking Davis, Colonel Poehler,
curly. You know what I mean? They're like, fuck that, man. I got four of them fucking things.
Anyway.
Yeah. That guy, he had a I saw him one time. He didn't do the edge dressing on his shoes. Fuck him.
Exactly. Who the hell does he think he is? Yeah. Right? But I'll tell you what.
He's got a uniform on top of that mountain, too. Look at that picture. God damn it. Where's his bayonet scabbard? Fuck him.
I don't think those guys did that, though. None of them wore the same fucking uniform.
Yeah, I know. I'm being honest.
Yeah, it wasn't the same back then. It doesn't appear.
I'm gonna frame this picture. I'm going to print it out. I got to get some photographic image paper, and I got to scan this thing and crop it, and I love this picture. Two guys in fucking combat shit on top of Iwo Jima saluting the American flag. That's fucking awesome. Anyway. All right, boys. First of all, thank you very much for the visit. And we'll pay attention the next couple of weeks. Hopefully we'll keep our fingers crossed. And the nation will get out of this in a hurry. And people go back and kind of put their lives back together. So we shall see. And again, Timmy, I hope everything you say is absolutely right. And the other thing I hope is this. I hope that the world tattoos the Chinese for this bullshit.
No shit.
Right?
That's exactly right.
Because they should be tattooed for it. Not only, you know, God only knows how it started, but their lack of warning the rest of the world and taking the right precautions and calling the right people in is bullshit. So, anyway.
That's where Ming the Merciless lives there, man.
There you go. There you go. More Bombing Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.